This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
Support for The Exchange Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. With our presidential primary long behind us, races are now shaping up for New Hampshire governor. This week, a prominent Republican joined the growing candidate group, Manchester Mayor Ted Gatsis.
People know that I don't run against them. I run for the office and put my experience and my leadership and my record on the line so that people can see it and show the accomplishments that we've had here in the city of Manchester. And believe that we can bring those same accomplishments to the state of New Hampshire.
Meanwhile, in the legislature, the rising toll of opioid addiction continued to occupy lawmakers' attentions. This week, a House committee debated needle exchange programs, especially whether someone turning in a needle with drug residues would still be arrested. Emergency room doctor Michelle Nathan told lawmakers that without that immunity, needle exchange centers would have a hard time convincing addicts to come in.
In all truth, addicts are paranoid. And if they think they can get arrested, they think they're going to get arrested no matter where they're going.
The state Senate this week rejected a proposal that it has strongly supported in the past, casino gambling. Sounding a bit defeated, lead sponsor and Manchester Senator Lou D'Alessandro agreed to let his bill die for the year.
I move to table.
Motion is to table. All in favor of tabling, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Table Senate Bill 551.
And on Capitol Hill, New Hampshire's Senate delegation weighed in on President Obama's choice to fill a U.S. Supreme Court vacancy, Judge Merrick Garland. Senate Republicans say they'll wait till after the presidential election to get the process going. But Democrats, like Jean Shaheen, says the Senate's obligated to begin now.
Granite Staters don't take election years off from their jobs, and I don't think the Senate or the president should take an election year off from our jobs to get a nominee that can fill the vacancy on the Supreme Court.
It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for the week are Josh Rogers, senior political reporter here at New Hampshire Public Radio. Josh, thanks for taking time out.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Gary, a busy week. Thank you.
Oh, good to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Dean Spiliota, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, as always, good to see you.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, and Dean, let's start with that U.S. Supreme Court story and put a New Hampshire spin on this. Just remind us, Dean, despite repeated assurances from Senate Republicans that they will not consider any President Obama Supreme Court nominee, the president went ahead and nominated someone anyway. How come?
Well, he would argue it's his constitutional responsibility to nominate someone, and then the Senate has the duty to advise and consent on that nomination. As you mentioned, Republicans have said that they're not going to move forward with a nomination in the Senate. He chose Merrick Garland, who is is the Chief Justice of the U.S. Court of Appeals for District of Columbia, which is one place where you often find rising Supreme Court justices. Is a 63-year-old. Viewed as fairly moderate, a moderate pick. And, you know, a lot of people think that this was Obama's attempt to kind of put Republicans in a very difficult place. This is somebody that Republicans had voted for in the past and said very complimentary things about. From a Republican perspective, he's about as good as you could expect from a Democratic president. Now, not surprisingly, progressives have been a little unhappy. They said, oh, great, you know, another white guy on the Supreme Court to replace Antonin Scalia. But he's very highly credentialed, certainly qualified to be a justice. And so you've now seen Republican senators bending over backwards to say it's not the individual. It's that we're in an election year. They want the people to register in the fall. They've even shot down the idea of a lame duck appointment in November. Let's say Hillary Clinton wins in November, with the specter of maybe a more liberal justice being nominated if she were to be once she was inaugurated. They could, in theory, confirm him after the election. They have said they're not even going to do that. So,
That's new. I hadn't heard that.
Yeah. So they're holding their ground. Although I think the White House strategy is to kind of work on some Republicans who are in swing states like New Hampshire and up for re-election to try to sort of crack the Republican facade a little bit.
Okay, so let's talk about New Hampshire, Josh. How's this playing out in the Granite State?
Well, it's become a very big issue in the Senate race between Governor Hassan and Senator Ayotte. Kelly Ayotte has said that she's willing to meet with Merrick Garland, but that the people's voices need to be heard, i.e. there needs to be an election. She doesn't suggest she's going to move, but she's one of a number of Senate Republicans facing tough re-elections that are put in a tough position by this, and certainly Democrats are using this as an opportunity to suggest that Republican conduct in this is emblematic of, you know, Washington dysfunction at its worst, to quote Governor Hassan. And, you know, while Dean is right that there doesn't seem to be any sign of Senate Republicans backing off, there have been some, including rather senior folks like Orrin Hatch of Utah, who has suggested an openness to potentially considering a lame duck appointment. And, you know, that's a tough position, too, because it's hard to say, well, we're standing on principle now, but, you know, once the principle doesn't align with the political reality, then we're going to do something different. And so this is complicated. There's money being spent on both sides of this race, of this issue across the country in New Hampshire. I mean, we obviously have ads running going after Kelly Ayotte on this. There are going to be ads supporting her coming in the next several days, too.
Well, we've gotten lots of Facebook comments on this. I'll just share a few. Bill says the people of New Hampshire, who Kelly Ayotte was elected to represent in the Senate, have spoken. We elected Barack Obama as president of the United States until January 2017. We elected Ayotte as senator until the same time. We expect her to do her job up until her last day in office, no matter what her, this is Bill's words here, Tea Party puppet masters say. Another comment from Erna. Garland is a very qualified jurist. I do understand why Republicans won't consider a hearing, but I think they're making a mistake. Had Obama nominated a leftist, Erna says, I would agree. Garland is not one. Just a little bit more, Dean, on Judge Garland. The Washington Post called him safe, conventional, even boring.
Yeah, he's very experienced, has worked for, I think, 18 years on the federal bench, is viewed as someone who has would go into the Supreme Court with the skill set you need to have an impact immediately. You know, the one drawback to give you a sense of sort of how Obama is kind of willing to move on this, he's 63, which means, you know, in theory, maybe 20 years on the court or so if he were confirmed. Increasingly, presidents have looked for people in their late 40s or early 50s. It's a way to maximize the number of years that you have an impact as president on the court. So, you know, the view was he's certainly qualified. He's been passed over, I think, twice in the past. He's sort of a perennial potential nominee, and he seemed very if you saw the White House ceremony, he was very moved. He was really excited about the opportunity, but it's going to be a very tough haul. I know they're going to try to pick off some of the senators, but I just think it's going to be very difficult.
It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email, exchange at nhpr.org. Thanks for those Facebook comments. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter as well. One more time, the Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Well, several stories concerning the outdoors and the environment made headlines this week, gentlemen. And with us now is NHPR's environment reporter Sam Evans-Brown to help us out with these stories. Sam, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first, a huge decision yesterday, Sam, concerning a proposed expansion at the Mount Sunapee State Park ski area. The private operator of the ski area has long, long, long wanted to stretch its footprint on the mountain, but needed state approval. So what happened?
So yesterday, it certainly wasn't a surprise, because about a year ago, we had the first indication that the Department of Resources and Economic Development was okay with this expansion. They put a draft out about a year ago that okayed the carving out of new ski trails on the western flank of Mount Sunapee. It would be four new top-to-bottom trails and a new high-speed detachable quad, as well as a new parking lot, a new base lodge.
So it's a lot.
It's a lot. It's a big expansion. But we knew for about a year that Dred was feeling like they were going to okay this. And basically yesterday we got the revisions to the draft, which included a number of concessions to opponents to the expansion. They eliminated one of the trails that would have gone through an ecologically sensitive area. If anything, the new vocabulary that New Hampshire can learn out of this, we've got exemplary natural communities, which are forest communities that deserve legal protection, according to state biologists. And so there's one of these that is being transected by the lift line, but the state took out a ski trail that was going to go through that exemplary natural community. And a number of other concessions. There's not going to be a mountain coaster anymore, and there was going to be a 20-foot setback. Should someone decide to develop condos next to the state park, it was going to have to be a 20-foot setback. That was increased to a 50-foot setback.
Well, we got an email from an opponent of this, Tom, who says, for over 100 years, Mount Sunapee's protected lands have served a higher purpose, the preservation and nature of nature and humanity's quiet, gentle enjoyment of our rare and priceless natural heritage. Tom says New Hampshire's park system is perhaps our most impressive accomplishment as a state. Our tradition of upholding the public trust and preserving land for future generations is fundamental to our granite character. Tom goes on to say, on Thursday, Hassan signaled the urgent undoing of this heritage. Tom says, forcing us to ask an essential question, what are New Hampshire's state parks for and for whom? And it sounds like from Tom's comments, Sam, and Tom, thank you very much, that opponents are not going to be satisfied with this change.
No, basically any expansion of the ski area is something that the opposition groups, Friends of Mount Sunapee, are not going to be happy with. And even though there were a number of changes designed to make this a more palatable expansion, I think any expansion period is not going to satisfy them.
Gary and then Josh. Go ahead, Gary.
Well, I mean, this has been going on for a long, long time. I think some people tend to forget how big a deal it was when we actually did lease Sunapee out, and not as opposed to running it as a state park and a state ski area. But this is, we had Governor Lynch was absolutely opposed to it, as was George Ball, the former Dred commissioner. We're seeing a change now. I mean, it's downsized considerably from what they originally proposed. I mean, there are all kinds of issues with this. It also, in terms of the land, it was donated for the park. Some of them had certain covenants on them. And it's been a very long, complicated process. And something tells me it's not over yet.
Yeah, Josh.
Well, I would agree with Gary. And also, I would point out that it is interesting to see the way the politics around this issue have, cooled down a little bit. They're still pretty hot right around Sunapee. But this, as Gary points out, was a big issue when the state first contemplated leasing the mountain. And then it was a big, big issue when Governor Lynch, it was a big issue for him. And one of the very few issues where he took an absolute stance on something from the beginning and pretty much kept to it. And so it is interesting to see how this has changed. And I guess we'll see where it goes. But, this is less of a, this seems like less of an issue of statewide concern than it once was.
Dean.
Yeah, this is a sort of a classic example of economic development bumping up against preservation of natural resources. The town of Goshen, which is on the backside of Sunapee, and is interested in the economic development because it would bring in more people into the town. And the question is whether or not they're going to build these slopeside condos. I mean, maybe Sam knows for sure, but that has been sort of the underlying issue, is whether or not the intention of this developer is to actually build those condos.
That's right, because you used to live in that area, Dean.
Yep, so yep, not maybe 8-10 miles away. Yep.
Sure. So lots more to this story, I think, Sam. Yes. Last question for you on this, and then we have two others we need to cover with you. So what happens next?
So it heads to the Executive Council, which historically was the big stumbling block for this proposal. When John Lynch was governor, basically he blocked it by making sure that it never got a vote at the Executive Council. It never got on the agenda. However, the developers have said that it's a very different tone in the Hassan administration, and I would anticipate that there is a vote. It might get pushed off a few weeks because opponents have been complaining about the fact that the documents were released yesterday and there's less than a week before the Executive Council has to make their decision. But I imagine that it will get on the agenda.
Another story, Sam, that I did want to cover with you. This week, the Department of Environmental Services and the state's realtors seem to reach agreement about how to warn potential home buyers about a colorless, odorless, yet dangerous gas called radon. This is very picky, Sam. Do your best here. What's this debate about?
So radon in the air is widely recognized to be the biggest threat to your health. So radon just bubbling up from the bedrock into your basement, into the air of your home. Radon in your water is also a concern, but less of one. And it's mostly a concern because, you know, when you take a shower, when you cook, that radon that's in the water bubbles up out of the water into your air.
I see.
So how much of a contribution is it making to the air quality or your home? And the science of it is very tricky. And basically, DES says that they looked at the science that was done, and ever since 1991, they've felt that there should be a flag at the level of 2,000 picocuries per liter. Break out another
Sounds like a Pokemon card.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, go ahead.
But other states have said that you really shouldn't worry until 10,000 picocuries per liter. And New Hampshire's advisory level, because this is not a legal limit, this is just advice to homeowners, that ours is the lowest in the country. And realtors have had a problem with this for a long time because they say that someone goes to buy a home, they see this advisory level from the state, and they use that as a point of leverage to get concessions from the seller. And it makes it more difficult to sell homes, and so realtors have said this level should be changed, and they should bring it in line with what the EPA says, which is basically if you have high radon in your water, then test your air. So the deal that was reached this week between realtors and the DES is that DES has said that basically what we have considered a yellow flag, the 2000 level, has been misinterpreted as a red flag. So new advisory levels that they're putting out say between 2000 and 10,000, you should consider treatment and you should test your air. Over 10,000 is when you should get really serious about treatment. And the realtors are happy with that. DES seems to be happy with that language. And so basically now we've got, you know, 2 to 10. Start getting concerned. Over 10, really get concerned.
You did a good job with that, but the language is still kind of, you know, for your average person, overwhelmed with paperwork at that, you know, that mortgage signing for anybody who's been through the process. I don't know. I'm wondering if people's eyes will just glaze over.
You know, I think that now that – because in the previous educational materials, the number 10,000 was never mentioned. The only number you saw was 2,000. And so people glom on to that. So now that I think there's a slightly more nuanced interpretation and the high number that people will see is 10,000, I think that sellers will look at that and they'll say, really, it's over 10 that we're willing to give you concessions. If you're concerned between 2 and 10, that's on you.
You're listening to the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. Let's check in with our spring fun drive. Gary Reno, this was a big deal at the State House, too, this issue of radon and the debate between realtors right. and DES and so forth. Go ahead.
There's a bill that was introduced at the realtors' request to basically make it the federal level as opposed to what the state has been doing. That bill now is likely to be killed because this is all settled between the realtors and the DES.
One more story, Sam, that we did want to ask you about. Finally, a long, long, long dispute over on the seacoast about a wastewater treatment plant for the city of Portsmouth was finally resolved with the city deciding to bond $75 million, I think it was, for a new plant. Why is this important, not just for the city, Sam, but really for the whole seacoast region?
So this is another long-running dispute between the EPA and coastal communities. The issue is nitrogen, the amount of nitrogen coming out of wastewater treatment plants, but also off of runoff and just coming out of the atmosphere, atmospheric deposition, is really tough on the aquatic habitat or the marine habitat in the Great Bay. And so the EPA has been pushing these coastal communities to upgrade their wastewater treatment plants to decrease the amount of nitrogen. The real sticking point has been how much they need to upgrade their plants. I won't be the guy who introduces another measure here, but basically there's a real big difference between the cleanest possible technology out there and sort of the minimum amount of improvement that you could make. And the coastal communities have been pushing for that minimum level, saying there's so much nitrogen coming from these other sources, from runoff, from atmospheric deposition, that the wastewater treatment plants really don't matter that much.
It's not completely our fault, so don't make us make this big expensive improvement.
And if we spend this extra money, it won't even improve the habitat this much because there are these other sources. And there was a big breakthrough in this a couple of years ago where the coastal communities managed to get a peer review done of the science, and the peer review had said that the DES didn't do a very good job in considering, you know, they were overstating the impact from these wastewater treatment plants. And now since that has come out, a settlement has been reached between Portsmouth and the EPA saying, you know, go ahead with that sort of that baseline level. And you're seeing this in other communities as well, where Exeter is moving moving forward. They had a $50 million wastewater treatment plant. You know, Durham already is down to that minimum level. Newmarket is moving forward with their wastewater treatment plant, which is only going to cost around $10 million. So basically, we're seeing the coastal communities slowly starting to come into compliance with what the EPA is asking them for.
All right, Sam, thank you so much for helping us out. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
NHPR's Sam Evans-Brown, our environment reporter, helping us catch up on a couple of the stories concerning the outdoors and the environment this week around the Granite State. It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup today in the Exchange, and you can join us, 1-800-892-6477. And Josh Rogers, Gary Reno, Dean Spiliotis, a couple more State House bills we should wrap up that received attention this week. I think I'll turn to you first, Josh. The perennial effort to bring casino gambling to this state seemed to go down in the Senate, but not completely. Can you help us out with that?
Well, it was tabled. There were some absences. This gambling, which has had an easy go of it in the Senate for some time, is facing a tougher fight this year. Originally, the bill, which is sponsored by Manchester Democrat Lou D'Alessandro and Senate President Chuck Morris of Salem, envisioned gambling at Rockingham Park. It was then amended by the committee to open up the location to a competitive bid process. That's always been a tension, more yeah. something you hear about in the House than
that was
than,
a problem
than,
for some folks.
Than
say,
you
why,
do in the Senate. Yeah. Why create a government monopoly, a government sanctioned monopoly, essentially? And so there was hope that you might pick up a vote, particularly that of Nashville Senator Kevin Avard. So it was tabled yesterday. The Senate has to act next week on all bills, so it's going to rise off the table, I would anticipate, next week. You know, whether it staggers around for a while and falls again or makes its way across the hall, we'll see. But even if it does, it's got a tough go in the House. Obviously, a casino bill has never cleared the House. Governor Hassan obviously supports casino gambling. She hasn't been behind this.
She's been quiet about this lately.
There's a lot going on, and there just seems to be a lot. You know, even backers of gambling believe that will tell you that you know the ship may have sailed on this.
So to use Josh's analogy, Gary, what do you think? Will it leap up from the table or will it rise from the table and stagger across the hall to the House? What do you think?
Well, if it leaps up from the table and staggers across, we will know when Lou makes the motion to bring it off the table that he's got the votes. Otherwise, it will stay there. But I think what will be interesting, too, is there's some talk going around the State House that they want to attach the Keno bill to it to try to win a couple other votes on it to maybe get it through, because the House has always enjoyed passed the Keno over to the Senate. The Senate's always killed it off, saying it complicates matters with our casinos. So if we attach it to the casino bill, maybe we'll get a couple of votes. And
is
we'll
it Groundhog Day, Gary? I'm sorry.
It seems that way.
So again, who knows?
Who knows?
Well, the interesting thing to me, Gary and Dean, I have a question for you too, sure. Is these bills seem to come up when the budget is, you know, super, super tight. Everybody's in crunch mode. That doesn't seem to be the case this time.
And it is. I mean, that's part of the problem. I mean, they would always love to have the money, but do they really need the money? Well, no, they don't really need the money now. So there's not a lot of urgency. Some of the votes that you would have picked up in the past because of the financial issues aren't there right now.
Well, and speaking of perennial bills, marijuana decriminalization, Dean Spiliotis, passed the House. What's your take on this time around?
Well, you know, the House approved it. They've done so, I think, pretty much every year in recent memory. This is to remove possession of a half ounce or less as a criminal penalty. We're currently the only state in New England for which any possession is an offense at all. So there's been this sort of pressure to move in this direction. There's attitudes in New Hampshire have become sort of increasingly liberal on the issue. You know, Governor Hassan has threatened to veto it in the past. I don't know that it's going to go anywhere, but I'm sure we'll be hearing of it again.
All right. Well, more weekly New Hampshire News Roundup coming up in just a moment. Stay with us. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. As always, you can join us as we catch up on some of the top Granite State headlines of the week. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Our guests this week are Josh Rogers, senior political reporter here at NHPR, Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And guys, I did want to wrap up a few more votes in the legislature this week with you on ways to combat New Hampshire's opioid addiction crisis. We did a whole hour on this yesterday, with recent numbers showing 430 Granite Staters died from drug overdoses last year. Never mind the widening community impacts on children and the criminal justice system and so forth. A couple bills to cover. Josh, to you first, please. Needle exchange. This week, a House committee deadlocked over the details of whether New Hampshire should allow needle exchange programs. Now, just remind us, for people who aren't familiar, what these are and what this bill was about.
Well, needle exchanges are the needle exchanges envisioned or contemplated under this bill would be not run by the state, but this would essentially enable them to be set up and would enable them to be set up by making sure that trace amounts of the drugs found on needles would not be a chargeable offense. And the idea is that, you know, allowing addicts to have clean needles and finding places where people can turn in dirty needles, is a public health benefit. And this is not something that is permitted under New Hampshire law right now. And this is a bill that was sponsored by Joe Hannon, who's a Republican from the Seacoast. And this is something that he, fought ahead on, and it started in the Health and Human Services Committee, and then it went to the Criminal Justice Committee. There are people who have different opinions on the messages sense, but it is interesting to watch the debate over drug bills move from what has historically been a criminal justice approach to more of a medical approach, or under the umbrella of kind of harm reduction, as the opioid crisis claims more lives and presents public health risks.
Well, and Dean, needle exchange programs are not unusual. Lots of states have these, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's viewed as kind of one of the key ways to cut down on the spread of things like HIV and hepatitis, and it's viewed as kind of a public safety issue. You know, there's been a lot of concern. We've seen stories in the news about people finding used needles on playgrounds it's become a general public health concern as the crisis has worsened. And so I think the sense is that the thinking is that while it wouldn't be a state-run program, it would give these organizations an opportunity to offer that. And again, the concern among law enforcement is that it may make it a little more difficult to kind of prosecute drug dealers. These are increasingly common around the country, and they have shown some positive effect on the transmission of these diseases.
Well, and also, Dean, correct me if I'm wrong, just an avenue for addicts to come and maybe even, if they're in the right place to
right.
get sober, to talk to somebody about how
Absolutely.
To do that.
Absolutely. It's a way to kind of channel people.
Outreach.
If they're going to these private centers or private organizations, it may be a way to kind of connect them up with resources that they might not otherwise have access to.
So, Gary, just give us a little more on what Josh alluded to, that the debate in the House this week was not over needle exchanges, good or bad, but more whether turning in a needle with trace amounts of heroin or another drug in it would be a criminal offense or not.
Well, it currently is a criminal offense, and this bill would repeal that. It also takes it out of the drug paraphernalia section of the law. And the Attorney General's office said, number one, when you do that, it's going to make it impossible for us to go get a warrant to search a car. And number two, law enforcement was saying, as you were saying, we can use this to get people into treatment. We can threaten them with charging them with it, or they can go seek alternative treatment, alternative ways and so on, and alternative programs. So this has been going back and forth. And as you might imagine, the Criminal Justice Committee deadlocked over this.
7-7,
seven to
right?
7-7. So it's coming out without recommendation.
How are they going to sort through these two? I can really see both sides here.
And it's a very difficult decision to make one way or the other. I mean, everybody, I think a lot of people said on the committee, if this was just a needle exchange program, I would vote for it. But when you're taking this penalty out of the law, then I'm not for it.
I wanted to ask you about another opioid-related bill this week in the legislature. And Josh, to you first. No, I think Gary, you first. Then Josh, I want your comments as well. The legislature and governor have also been disputing where the money should come from for these anti-drug efforts here in the state. Fill us in there, Gary.
Well, this has been going on for a while. If you remember back to the task force, they had like a three-tier system that they put together. We have these that we're going to fast track. We have these that are early. And then we have just normal process. So we got the three bills fast track. They went through, except one of them got hung up.
The K through 12 education.
Got hung up. And then the ones that were supposed to get early consideration were mostly the money bills. And they were saying we can't decide this until we get the comprehensive annual audit that gets done so we know what the surplus is.
I see.
So they held it up. But what has happened now is that everything has been held up. All these money bills are still sitting there. And it's all going through the normal process. And I think Hassan decided this week that I've had enough, you know. All fall long, they criticized me for whatever I did. It was because I vetoed the bill that these programs weren't getting set up. So I'm going to call them on this one. And so there was a bill that it was actually her bill that she wanted introduced in a special session that never got introduced because we had the task force instead. so she said she wanted $5 million for the governor's commission on alcohol, drug abuse, prevention, et cetera. And another $300,000 or $400,000 for a new prosecutor to deal just with drugs in the AG's office. And the committee basically said, well, we'll cut it in half for what you want for the commission, but they're going to have to go through fiscal, which they don't have to do now, fiscal committee. And the money's got to come from lapses or money unspent.
Can't
be new money in both instances. And she said, wait a minute. We got $60 million surplus in revenues. Why are you doing this? I don't think you're really serious about getting these things through.
Wow. Okay. So how carefully do lawmakers, Josh, and the governor have to tread on this issue, promoting what they think is right fiscally, but also not being seen as politicizing this very tricky, difficult issue?
Well, I think it's fair to say that it's a challenge for everybody. It's also a challenge for politicians not to act like politicians in an election year. And they're all doing that in their own ways. I mean, the governor certainly wants to spend this money now and thinks it's warranted. Democrats on the Senate floor last week when this issue also sort of flared up, were saying we need to spend now because we have a crisis. You know, Republicans say, you know, we need to make sure that the money we're spending is, you know, responsibly being allocated, and that we're not throwing money at something when things aren't ready. Senate Finance Chair Jeanie Forrester said she was disappointed that the governor is focused on politicizing the opioid crisis. I think it's fair to say that everybody is politicizing it. It's interesting. It'll be interesting to see how this plays as an election issue because, you know, I don't doubt the sincerity of all these folks in terms of caring about the issue. How voters are going to see something like this where it doesn't really break along any kind of like partisan, clear partisan line. I mean, another front on which this is being fought is the whole battle over the reappointment of a drug czar after Jack Wozniak left. You know, the governor says she's moving as fast as she can and she's interviewing candidates. And then meanwhile, you have somebody like Chris Sununu, who's running for governor, sits on the executive council now saying, well, you know, we need to move fast on this. You know, he didn't support the position back when it was put into place. And so, you know, there's the politics around this are interesting. And, you know, we also see it in Washington with Kelly Ayotte fighting for federal funding, and in her political events, her actions on behalf of the opioid crisis are front and center. So this is clearly something that she thinks will play well for her electorally. In the meantime, there are a lot of moving parts in order to modernize New Hampshire's system, and you know, a part of this crisis is really one of how do you navigate the delivery of treatment services, and there's a lot of kind of technical health delivery stuff. There's a law enforcement component, and there's certainly a political component.
Yeah, how about that political component, Dean Spilios? Yeah. I'd love your thoughts, too. Josh has laid it out well that, people are doing their best. Everybody seems like they sincerely want to tackle this, but people have different ideas about how to do it and how to pay for
it. Yeah, it's fascinating to see what is clearly going to be a central political issue. Every candidate for pretty much every office, statewide office, is talking about it from some particular perspective. But then you see the sort of the politics overlaid on kind of the classic spending debates between Republicans and Democrats in the state legislature. And I think, you know, it's going to be interesting to see the extent to which, you know, Governor Hassan is in the middle of this, but she's going to run for Senate. And in some sense, the issue politically will be handed off to all the now many gubernatorial candidates who are running to replace her. So it's just interesting to see the collision of what is a very critical public health issue and policy issue with the sort of longstanding divisions about spending between Republicans and Democrats at the State House.
Again, it's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. So, Dean, some decisions on this also at the local level. At the school district level, for example, this week, Manchester's school board appears close to deciding whether to stock Narcan in some schools. That's the anti-overdose drug. Most people have heard of it. How unusual a step is this, Dean?
Well, I think it's going to become increasingly common. We've heard a number of school districts around the state talking about doing this, particularly in areas where there have been issues with drug abuse. Nashua, I think, has also approved stocking them in the school. The idea would be that the nurse would be able to administer the drug on campus. You know, opponents have said that basically what you're doing is creating a safe zone for drug abuse at schools, that students would know that they can abuse the drugs, and if anything goes wrong, the nurse is going to revive them with the Narcan. And I guess there's also some concern. I'm not as familiar with the effects of the Narcan, but I guess some people can come out of it and be combative, and there's some concern that that may make the school liable for injuries to the nurse or for other faculty. So I think you're going to have sort of the technicalities debated and ironed out, but it does seem like now that this is available over the counter at pharmacies, that you may see schools stocking them well in these sort of areas where there's concern.
Well, Nashua, I think I read, has had this for a couple of weeks. Berlin is on its way.
Right.
Gary, did you want to jump in on that?
No. I just think it's the same. We're going to see more and more of this. The state right now is providing this for free to the schools, so I think a lot of them want to take advantage of that.
Well, again, from Facebook, we've got Ryan who says, much rather see this, meaning Narcan in schools, than dying kids. Patricia says, wow, times have changed. Again, you can join us on Facebook or Twitter. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Speaking of Manchester, Josh Rogers, this week, Manchester Mayor Ted Gatsis announced his intention to run for governor. What does Ted Gatsis bring to this race in terms of experience and political resume?
Well, he's in his fourth term as mayor of Manchester. He was in the state Senate, briefly served as Senate president. He was an alderman as well in Manchester. Obviously well-known in Manchester, he barely survived a tough re-election against Joyce Craig. He won by fewer than 100 votes. He's made much of his efforts to deal with the drug problems in Manchester. I would expect that to be a central issue for him as well. You know, he certainly brings a large personality to the race and, you know, some decent name recognition. And so we will see. I mean, right now we have Chris Sununu, executive counselor, son of former Governor Sununu, and Frank Edelblue, who's a House member, reasonably well-heeled, not terribly well-known. You know, more to come perhaps. So,
and that's just on the Republican
side.
side.
On the Democratic side, we have Colin Van Ostern, executive counselor, Mark Connolly, former state securities regulator, and I don't know, maybe Steve Marchand, it seems like, now that Stephanie Shaheen has said she's not going to run. She's former city councilor, daughter of Gene Shaheen.
All right. You're listening to the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. Let's check back in with our March fund drive. I'd love to ask you too, Gary, and you too, Dean, about Ted Gatsis getting in. Gary, what do you think? Would you describe Ted Gatsis, for example, if somebody didn't know him, wasn't familiar with him, as a moderate Republican?
I think he's kind of fits the classic fiscal conservative moderate on the social issues, with the exception of abortion, probably. He's getting in. But I see that he lines up pretty well with Chris Sununu. They kind of share the same outlook in a lot of ways, which will make it a little, there's not going to be a huge ideological difference there between the two of them. It's amazing. I mean, he's got some, he has Andrew Cruz, who is the owner of AutoFair, is his chairman. So he's going to have a lot of money because Cruz can really raise money for people. And so Gatsis is going to have a lot of money. And it's going to take a couple million dollars, about $1 million or so maybe in the early primaries to
I'm sorry to interrupt you there, Gary. Just quick historical note. Now, I've been covering New Hampshire for 21 years almost. And I don't remember a Manchester mayor becoming governor before.
We were trying to figure this out yesterday.
I'm sure it has at some point, but it's been a while.
It's been a long, long while, if ever there's been a Manchester mayor who has been governor. There have been some Manchester mayors who've run for governor.
Yes.
But not all – I mean, seldom as the mayor of Manchester did they run for governor. Some of them ran after they were mayor. And so
I think Emil Beaulieu ran once in the primary.
But it was after he was
– Sure. Mayor.
And it is true that Manchester – I mean, it hasn't – the Manchester mayor seat, I mean, Frank Ginta managed to make it to Congress out of there. But in recent years, it has not been some springboard outside of the Queen City.
Well, the Queen City has a great way of sort of casting these people away after a little while. You know, I mean, we've had 3 or 4 terms, time for you to go. So it kind of ruins your political career when that happens.
Although Ted Gatsis, I think Josh mentioned this, was in the state Senate for a long time and served and, you know, worked with Democrats and so forth.
He was part of the palace coup that did in Tom Eaton when he was Senate president.
Yeah, oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And I mean, and certainly he is somebody who he likes policy issues. I mean, he spent a lot of time. He was very much into the budget. He was into school funding. He, pushed his version of casino gambling aggressively in the Senate. And, it will be interesting to see what sort of policy ideas he brings to this race.
Well, he's talking about basically bringing a lot of the issues from his time as mayor to the statewide level, the opioid crisis, local control of education. He talked yesterday about the stagnant economy, although, our unemployment rate is like 2.7 or 2.9%.
Yeah, we're going to look more at that on Monday.
So
it
that's
going to, striking.
Yeah, it is striking. So, I think we sort of pretty much know what to expect. I think it's going to be interesting now that Chris Sununu finally has, a well-known challenger. And then, on the Democratic side, Colin Van Ostern has been out there a long time organizing and fundraising. Mark Connolly has also been very active. Andrew Hosmer, state senator, just endorsed Mark Connolly. So I think that's going to be a good race as well. And if Steve Marchand, the former Portsmouth mayor, gets in, he's someone who's often mentioned as a potential statewide candidate. So it's going to be an interesting race.
So if you're feeling bereft because the New Hampshire primary is over, fear
it's
not. We've got the governor's race. Go ahead,
and
Gary.
I think within the next couple of weeks, we're also going to hear from Jeannie Forrester, that she's probably going to get into the race for governor on the Republican side, too.
Okay. And again, a well-known figure in the State House, leader on policy issues.
Not necessarily statewide, but well-known in the State House.
Well, one more story in electoral politics. Another person has his eye on the Executive Council. Josh, first of all, just remind us, what is the Executive Council? Now, we all know, but some people might not really know what it does.
The Executive Council, to quote the late Ray Burton, is the board of directors of the state of New Hampshire. They vote on appointments, they vote on contracts, and they're part of the executive branch.
New Hampshire's the only state with this.
There are 5 of them, and they play an important but not terribly high profile function in allowing the government to run. And Dan Weeks, who was a director of Open Democracy and the New Hampshire Rebellion, he's going to run in. Is District 5, the district held by David Wheeler. He's running as a Democrat. He would face Jennifer Daler, former state rep. She's also in that race in the primary. The Executive Council is interesting.
Josh, I'm going to cut you off there. I do apologize. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Our guests for this week's roundup are Gary Reno, Statehouse reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, Josh Rogers, Statehouse reporter and senior political reporter for us here at NHPR, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. You can join us as we cover some of the top headlines of the week. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. One more time, 1-800-892-6477 is the number. And gentlemen, I did want to ask you about some honors that were given this week, Gary Reno, to the police chief in Manchester for his work against the opioid crisis in that city, really reflecting how police departments around the state have tried to adopt new approaches toward this crisis.
Well, Manchester has really been, if you will, ground zero for this whole crisis. And they've had over 100 people, just about 100 people died last year out of the 400 in New Hampshire died in Manchester from overdoses. And they've done a lot of interesting things down there. This Granite Hammer, where they worked with the state police to set up they do this data mining, if you will. When are the arrests made? What time of the day? And so on. And they target these hot spots and go in and sweep up all the people that they can and then start moving up the chain, if you will, to find the dealers and so on. So Nick Willard, who has been Manchester police chief for about a year now, I guess, has been named to a national task force on the opioid issue here. It's done by the National League of Cities and the National Association of Counties. He's the only law enforcement person on there. So it's quite an honor, and I'm sure he Manchester is the poster child for this whole issue, and he seems to be out front of it. He's been out front of it since he's been police chief. He called on the state to help out more, and he's called for other things, various, and more cooperation with everybody to try to combat this issue.
Well, an honor and a tribute to the hard work he's done. Picking up on that word you use, poster child, Gary. Dean, I think I saw recently that New Hampshire itself has kind of become a poster child for this opioid crisis. There's been national coverage of the things going on here. You know, in a way, the attention is, warranted and maybe even wanted because people can then move to do things to solve this crisis. But in a way, it doesn't make New Hampshire... It's not quite the tourist image that you want.
Yeah, it really started with the presidential primary. A number of the candidates sort of latched onto it as a way to kind of connect with voters and share their own personal experiences with substance abuse and loss within their families. Jeb Bush, Chris Christie, and others talked about it. We saw it woven into campaign ads. I can tell you, just last week, I was watching, I think it was last Friday night, or sometime during the week, ABC's 2020, that evening magazine
That's
show.
That's it. That made a big
and
splash.
And it was David Muir, the national anchor.
Yes.
And their sort of test case was Manchester and then the seacoast. And the whole story was really about New Hampshire. So, and it is sort of ironic given that we typically rank pretty high in terms of sort of jobs, the economy, education, all those sorts of things.
Livability, wellness.
Yeah, tourism, all that. Yet you have this problem festering in various pockets around the state.
Well, I did want to ask you, Dean, also for an update, please, on a story that was huge news last summer concerning a young man from Vermont named Owen LaBrie. This is the young man who, on the eve of graduating from the prestigious St. Paul's School in Concord, was charged with sexual assault of a minor for pressuring a 15-year-old classmate to have sex. That was the charge, which he denied, but lost his court case. So now he's under curfew, Dean, at his mother's house in Vermont. This week, though, news reports said LaBrie was seen violating his curfew. How did this information get out?
Yeah, this is a fascinating story. It's really jumped right back into the top of the national headlines, and it had sort of kind of disappeared a little bit from the headlines. Owen LaBrie is under curfew. He needs to be in his mother's house in Tunbridge, Vermont, between 5 p.m. and 8 a.m., according to the court dictates. And he was down in Boston visiting his girlfriend at Harvard. He was awarded a full scholarship to Harvard that he then lost as a result of this court case. So he's visiting his girlfriend at Harvard. He ran into a reporter, I think, on the metro, on the T. And so she started chatting with him, and he said he was trying to get home. He had to take a bus up to Hanover, and then and those of you who know Tunbridge, it's not easy to get to, kind of northwest of White River Junction.
Yeah, it takes a while to get from Hanover to Tunbridge.
So it's an undertaking. So and then she tweeted about this, and it got national attention. And now prosecutors are claiming, and there's a hearing today to revoke his bail, that he has missed curfew on 8 occasions. He says it's to meet with his lawyers, but there is this question of what he was doing down in Cambridge and in Boston. So we'll find out today whether he was sentenced to, I think, a year in jail. And so in theory, he could be ordered to jail. His attorneys say that because he was so concerned with the reporter about getting back to Vermont, that shows that he is at least keeping with the spirit of his curfew requirements. But, we'll see how it plays out. I think it's this afternoon.
Yeah, the filing made by LaBrie's defense attorneys also point out that and I don't know how absolutely true this is, that his curfew, the 5 p.m. to 8 a.m., is a lot more restrictive than the typical curfew, and that it impedes his ability to, you know, potentially be, you know, a functioning member of society while he's on bail, to look into educational options, to gain some sort of employment. We'll see how that plays with the judge.
So 8 to 5. So that's
5 to 8.
Okay, 5 p.m. to 8 a.m. Okay, so that is a long window. That's his argument, Josh. Yeah. Did you want to jump in, Gary?
No, I think it's all been said.
All right. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Gary, did want to ask you about the State Fish and Game Department. Already has begun planning the moose hunt lottery for much later this year. Now, this has been a controversial issue, Gary, given the struggles that moose populations have had. What's the agency looking at?
Well, they're looking at dropping the number of permits that they will allow. I mean, it's a lottery. Everybody throws their hat in the ring, if you will, and you get the prized lottery moose permit to go out and try to kill your moose. And they want to drop it from 105 per year down to 71. Because of the decline in the moose population. On the other side, we have the turkeys. When if any of you are driving around the roads of New Hampshire, you know that they are everywhere. And they want to up the number of days that you can hunt turkeys in the state as well. And there's some changes with the deer population and pheasants and all that, trying to adjust it to the realities of what's going on out there in the wild, in the wilds.
Well, and I almost hit some turkeys on my way to the vet's office a few months back, and that was not in a rural area. And then I was out on my bike around Concord, and I had to stop because a flock was crossing in front of me. So could people who are disappointed that they can't hunt a moose be just as happy hunting a turkey, Gary?
When we first started talking about moose permits, hunting moose, somebody once described it as sort of like shooting your neighbor's Volkswagen, and it was much fun.
Because they just sort of stand there,
big. They're big. Whereas a turkey presents, they're not too fast on their feet either, so they're not that hard to hit either. But I think it's a little different than trying to shoot at a moose and shoot at a turkey.
All right. Gary? Dean? Josh?
There are a lot of turkeys out there. There have been many. I've been astonished by the number of turkeys that have, been hanging out in my yard this spring. It seems like more than in prior years, I will say that.
You ever tempted to take one for Thanksgiving or too much work?
I understand they're not really great to eat because there are a lot of worms and stuff like that.
But. All right. Well, speaking of food, one more subject I did want to cover with you guys. We've covered this a lot on The Exchange. The ongoing debate over school lunch and, in the opinions of kids, how healthy Dean Spiliotis, is too healthy. Londonderry School District has been pushing some innovations here, getting a lot of attention, a lot of it favorable. They did drop out of the federal school lunch program so they could really pursue their own path. But banning corn dogs was a move too far. Now, you and I have middle schoolers.
Yep.
What happened with Londonderry Middle School?
This is like grassroots civic engagement in action. Londonderry brought in a new director of dining services, and she took corn dogs off of the menu because of a lack of, I think the phrase was, nutritional integrity, which I assume is nutritional value. And she replaced it with pierogies, which are, dumplings. And the students were not big fans of those pierogies. So they started, a number of enterprising students started a petition to get the pierogies off the menu. And they used that as kind of a springboard to meet with the director and kind of negotiate. And this is almost like negotiating like a Supreme Court pick or something. They didn't get corn dogs back on. But they negotiated for mozzarella sticks. So that's, it's a good lesson in bipartisan compromise. And then they also made some other suggestions for the breakfast menu, et cetera, that have been quite popular. So it was a good, faculty saw it as kind of a good lesson for students political engagement, essentially. Though I think the director is now out on maternity leave, so it's rumored that they're going to try to sneak the corn dogs back in while she's out.
Okay. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. Let's check in with our March fund drive. So, gentlemen, I always like to spend the last couple minutes of the weekly news roundup finding out what you will be covering next week and talking a little bit about what we'll be up to next week. So, Josh, tell us what you're going to be working on next week.
Well, we try to get out and see what's happening on the hustings with all these people who are now signaling that they're going to run for office or who are actively running. You know, it certainly feels like spring is upon us. I hope it doesn't snow on Monday. But, you know, people's minds are turning to the fall, and certainly, you know, the courtship of voters is beginning.
So you said people who are already out on the hustings and people who might be getting in.
Yeah.
Can you tantalize us a little bit there, Josh?
Well, I mean, I'm just some of the people we talked about. I mean, people who are now going to be actively running, you know, seeing how they're pitching themselves and seeing how people are reacting. I mean, I do think the first congressional district, for instance, is going to be very interesting, the variety of candidates and what they represent within the current churn of the GOP. I think it's going to be interesting to watch in a district that's bounced back and forth a lot. And, you know, the governor's race, you know, that's wide open.
Yeah, and just remind us real quick, and then I'm going to turn to you guys too. But, Josh, the Republican race, first district, Frank Into, the sitting congressman who's had some trouble with the Elections Commission, and then Dan Innes, who's seen as the more moderate Republican businessman. And then the third person,
Pam Tucker, who's
more conservative.
Conservative House member, sort of comes out of the, you know, kind of Tea Party inflected sort of brand of politics, less compromising perhaps than some. And, you know, Rich Ashe, who's expected to get into the race, and he's, you know, more.
He's run for this before.
You would consider him more of a sort of traditional, sort of pro business. You know, small government Republican.
Wow. Okay,
I guess.
So,
so you have you've got a bunch going on there, and you know it is interesting. I don't know. Until you get in the room with candidates and voters, and you see how they interact, it's really hard to know.
What are you up to next week, Dean?
You know, Josh is absolutely right. I find myself increasingly talking about these races. There is a lot of national interest in that first congressional district, and also a lot of national interest in the Senate race. So I think it's fun to see those developing. It's going to be a great governor's race. District 2, you're hearing less about right now. I think there's the Flanagan guy.
Jack Flanagan, the former majority leader of the House.
Got in on the Republican side, and Annie Custer is the incumbent, but I think it's going to be a great race, great set of races, and that's what people seem to want to talk about now. The presidential primary has faded a little bit. You can only talk about Donald Trump so much, so now we're talking about all these races.
Really, what is that? What is that so much? I'm not sure.
And we have crossover at the State House, which means
right.
that the,
real quick, tell us what that is, Gary.
All the
yeah.
Senate bills have to go to the House, and all the House bills to the Senate. So it's probably the worst time of the year to deal with it. And so we have like 100 bills the House has to deal with this week, almost as many in the Senate. It's going to be a long week. And then we also have the Senate hearing on the Medicaid expansion bill this week as well on Tuesday.
Okay. So we'll have lots to cover.
So it'll be a very busy week.
Sure. Like an accountant before tax day. That's
exactly,
you next week, Gary Reno.
Absolutely.
All of you, thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it. This is The Exchange on NHPR.